We're back together again in the synthesis of yoga, the yoga of divine works. We're in the chapter, the ascent of the sacrifice, one, the works of knowledge, the psychic being. We're not going to finish the chapter tonight. We're going to go a few pages farther and break in the middle of the section and then finish the chapter next week. If knowledge is the widest power of the consciousness, and its function is to free and illumine, yet love is the deepest and most intense, and its privilege is to be the key to the most profound and secret recesses of the divine mystery. Man, because he is a mental being, is prone to give the highest importance to the thinking mind and its reason and will, and to its way of approach and effectuation of truth, and even he is inclined to hold that there is no other. The heart, with its emotions and incalculable movements, is to the eye of his intellect an obscure, uncertain, and often a perilous and misleading power which needs to be kept in control by the reason and the mental will and intelligence. And yet there is in the heart, or behind it, a profounder mystic light which, if not what we call intuition, for that, though not of the mind, yet descends through the mind, has yet a direct touch upon truth and is nearer to the divine than the human intellect in its pride of knowledge. According to the ancient teaching, the seat of the immanent divine, the hidden Purusha, is in the mystic heart, the secret heart cave, Hridaya Guhayam, as the Upanishads put it. And according to the experience of many yogins, it is from its depths that there comes the voice or the breath of the inner oracle. So that's the opening paragraph in this section. I've looked for this Sanskrit term, Hridaya Guhayam, in the Upanishads, and I have not been able to find it. I have found a couple of passages which are close in the Brihadaranyaka 5.6.1. There's a reference to Antar Hridayam, which is the inner heart. And that says, translated into English, this person who consists of mind is of the nature of light, is within the heart like a grain of rice or barley. He is the ruler of all, the lord of all, and governs all this, whatever there is. There's also a phrase in the Chandogya Upanishad at 3.14.3, which says, Admantar Hridaya, which is basically, this is my self within the heart, the self inside the heart. There's also a section in the Maitri Upanishad which is very like what we had in the Brihadaranyaka. But if you find where this phrase occurs, Hridaya Guhayam, exactly that, please let me know. But it's clear that his main point is that coming into oneness with the divine through the mind, raising its power of knowledge into sublime regions, is one way. Another way, though, is to profoundly to go inside through the heart and establish oneness with the divine there. And that is an even more intense and rapturous experience. Sri Aurobindo is fortunate to have reached the culmination of both paths. But inside, in the heart behind the heart, is where Sri Aurobindo finds the key to the cosmos. But it is there, in the enlivening, ennobling power that the emerging soul brings to the outer nature, that we find the way to link the divine above to the divine within, and potentially to transform not simply human life, but to introduce the living element of divinity into the world, into the cosmos. So it is incumbent upon aspirants in the integral yoga to find the means, the methods, by which we bring effectively forward this psychic force from within us. He continues here, this ambiguity, these opposing appearances of depth and blindness are created by the double character of the human emotive being. For there is in front in man a heart of vital emotion similar to the animals, if more variously developed. Its emotions are governed by egoistic passion, blind instinctive affections, and all the play of the life impulses with their imperfections, perversions, often sordid degradations. A heart besieged and given over to the lusts, desires, wraths, intense or fierce demands, or little greeds and mean pettinesses of an obscure and fallen life force, and debased by its slavery to any and every impulse. This mixture of the emotive heart and the sensational hungering vital creates in man a false soul of desire. It is this that is the crude and dangerous element which the reason rightly distrusts and feels a need to control, even though the actual control, or rather coercion, it succeeds in establishing over our raw and insistent vital nature remains always very uncertain and deceptive. But the true soul of man is not there. It is in the true invisible heart, hidden in some luminous cave of the nature. There, under some infiltration of the divine light, is our soul, a silent inmost being of which few are even aware. For, if all have a soul, few are conscious of their true soul or feel its direct impulse. There dwells the little spark of the divine, which supports the obscure mass of our nature, and around it grows the psychic being, the formed soul, or the real man within us. Now, we'll pause for a moment because the context here is interesting. Remember, Sri Aurobindo is revising this in 1932. It's only later, as he takes up the life divine, roughly 7 years later, I guess, and revises chapter 23, The Double Soul in Man, where he sort of defines what is this relationship between the inmost being and the outer nature in our psychology. Because when we look at the outer mind, the outer emotions that we have, it does seem as if it's outside us when we live deep, deep, deep within us. So there in The Double Soul in Man, chapter 23 in The Life Divine, he sort of sets before us the architecture in a way he doesn't even achieve here. But here he's writing in a way that isn't published. Remember, he's writing this in 1932. It doesn't see publication for a long time. But he's putting here a definition, and drawing a sketch of the larger psychic reality that even the people living around him in the ashram have not seen. As he's writing individually to one correspondent and another, explaining what is the nature of the psychic, how do you get to it? And he's allowing the mother the opportunity to enforce the emergence of that psychic potential inside the sadhaks and sadhikas. But nobody has seen these magnificent sentences which we're reading tonight. There dwells the little spark of the divine. So inside is that psychic essence. Remember that Upanishad, the Mundaka Upanishad, describes a great reality, like a central fire, throwing out thousands and millions of sparks from itself. So each one of those sparks comes from that central fire, like a ray of light comes from the sun. Each one of those sparks represents your individual soul. And it is at the very center of your being. It is that around which develops the psychic being. So always, this touch of the eternal, immortal, coming into time, stands at the center of your nature. This, when you are trying to dissolve your attachment to ego and to the frontal person, is not destroyed by that dissolution. That continues. This is the secret of your personal existence, and this is the thread of continuity that carries you always back to the Supreme. That can never be broken, because you are that. That is you. So that spark is at the very center of your soul, and it is the Divine Presence. Around it develops the psychic being, as he calls it, the formed soul, or the real man within us. See how he capitalizes that word. Purusha really means man. We think of it as translated as the conscious person, but it means man. So the real person, the real man inside of you, is the Purusha developed, manifested from the psychic essence, from the divine essence within you. Sri Aurobindo's psychology is much more subtle than the simplicity of the Sankhya system, which makes this simple division between Purusha and Prakriti, even accounting for all the emotional and mental and subtle physical aspects that there are in the Sankhya system. Sri Aurobindo's psychology is still more subtle and far-reaching and profound. Of that another time. It is as this psychic being in him grows and the movements of the heart reflect its divinations and impulsions that man becomes more and more aware of his soul, ceases to be a superior animal, and awakening to glimpses of the Godhead within him admits more and more its intimations of a deeper life and consciousness and an impulse towards things divine. It is one of the decisive moments of the integral yoga when this psychic being, liberated, brought out from the veil to the front, can pour the full flood of its divinations, seeings, and impulsions on the mind, life, and body of man, and begins to prepare the upbuilding of divinity in the earthly nature. This would take us right now to Savitri and to that section in the parable of the soul where he declaims this reality. But we'll wait and we'll read that at the close of the evening. By the way, I think it's worth noting that when Sri Aurobindo is using the English language of the day. He will frequently use the term man to stand for all of humanity, or mankind, similarly. That was the usage of English then. We don't do that anymore. Sri Aurobindo was not implying a gender bias with this use of the language. Rather, Purusha and Prakriti, Shiva and Shakti, Ishwara, Ishwari, imply differences in status and dynamism within the single divine. The idea of duality is not fundamental. The idea of manifestation is fundamental to an integrative vision. As in the works of knowledge, so in dealing with the workings of the heart, we are obliged to make a preliminary distinction between two categories of movements: those that are either moved by the true soul or aid towards its liberation and rule in the nature, and those that are turned to the satisfaction of the unpurified vital nature. Now, you may remember when we were talking about the works of knowledge, Sri Aurobindo made a firm distinction between the higher knowledge and the lower, paravidya and aparavidya. Here there is a similar comparison. But the distinctions ordinarily laid down in this sense are of little use for the deeper spiritual purpose of yoga. Thus, a division can be made between religious emotions and mundane feelings, and it can be laid down as a rule of spiritual life that the religious emotions alone should be cultivated, and all worldly feelings and passions must be rejected and fall away from our existence. This in practice would mean the religious life of the saint or devotee, alone within with the divine, or linked only to others in a common God love, or at the most, pouring out the fountains of a sacred, religious, or pietistic love on the world outside. This has a rather monastic feel to it, that dividing sharply between the sacred and the profane. For Sri Aurobindo, again, it is a unitive experience revealing the divine from within the mundane, which is a principal aim of his yoga. But religious emotion itself is too constantly invaded by the turmoil and obscurity of the vital movements, and it is often either crude or narrow or fanatical or mixed with movements that are not signs of the spirit's perfection. It is evident, besides, that even at the best, an intense figure of sainthood, clamped in rigid hieratic lines, is quite other than the wide ideal of an integral yoga. Hieratic, by the way, is a word drawn from the Greek hieros, meaning the sacred. Here it means simply priestly. A larger psychic and emotional relation with God in the world, more deep and plastic in its essence, more wide and embracing in its movements, more capable of taking up in its sweep the whole of life, is imperative. So there should be nothing that the soul can approach in the manifest universe that cannot be brought into the experience of a universal divinity. That largeness is demanded of an integral yoga. We can say no to nothing. We must say yes to everything. A wider formula has been provided by the secular mind of man, of which the basis is the ethical sense, for it distinguishes between the emotions sanctioned by the ethical sense and those that are egoistic and selfishly common and mundane. It is the works of altruism, philanthropy, compassion, benevolence, humanitarianism, service, labor for the well-being of man and all creatures that are to be our ideal. To shuffle off the coil of egoism and grow into a soul of self-abnegation that lives only or mainly for others or for humanity as a whole is the way of man's inner evolution according to this doctrine. So this is the social amelioration so popular during the 19th and 20th century. Or, if this is too secular and mental to satisfy the whole of our being, since there is a deeper religious and spiritual note there that is left out of account by the humanitarian formula, a religio-ethical foundation can be provided for it. And such was indeed its original basis. To the inner worship of the divine or the supreme by the devotion of the heart, or to the pursuit of the ineffable by the seeking of a highest knowledge, can be added a worship through altruistic works or a preparation through acts of love, of benevolence, of service to mankind, or to those around us. It is indeed by the religio-ethical sense that the law of universal goodwill or universal compassion or of love and service to the neighbor, the Vedantic, the Buddhistic, the Christian ideal, was created. Only by a sort of secular refrigeration, extinguishing the fervor of the religious element in it, could the humanitarian ideal disengage itself and become the highest plane of a secular system of mental and moral ethics. I hope you appreciated the humor with which he was writing that. He took great delight, no doubt, in chiseling out that sentence. For, in the religious system, this law of works is a means that ceases when its object is accomplished or a side issue. It is a part of the cult by which one adores and seeks the divinity, or it is a penultimate, next to the last, step of the excision of self in the passage to nirvana. In the secular ideal, it is promoted into an object in itself. It becomes a sign of the moral perfection of the human being, or else it is a condition for a happier state of man upon earth, a better society, a more united life of the race. But none of these things satisfy the demand of the soul that is placed before us by the integral yoga. So again, this is the social and communal institutions that stand placed between the aspirant and the direct experience of the divine. We do this, in a sense, in preparation to, and then we advance farther. Or do we? We often get frozen simply in the service to mankind, or in the service to God in man, in the religious field, or simply slogging away at social amelioration programs, improvement of the community, and we never gain access to the actual experience that gives it all life and all meaning. Altruism, philanthropy, humanitarianism, service are flowers of the mental consciousness and are at best the mind's cold and pale imitation of the spiritual flame of universal divine love. Not truly liberative from ego sense, they widen it at most and give it a higher and larger satisfaction. Impotent in practice to change man's vital life and nature, they only modify and palliate its action and daub over its unchanged egoistic essence. This is not a radical change. This is merely moving molecules around. Or, if they are intensely followed with an entire sincerity of the will, it is by an exaggerated amplification of one side of our nature. In that exaggeration, there can be no clue for the full and perfect divine evolution of the many sides of our individualized being towards the universal and transcendent eternal. Nor can the religio-ethical ideal be a sufficient guide. For this is a compromise or compact of mutual concessions for mutual support between a religious urge, which seeks to get a closer hold on earth by taking into itself the higher turns of ordinary human nature, and an ethical urge, which hopes to elevate itself out of its own mental hardness and dryness by some touch of a religious fervor. In making this compact, religion lowers itself to the mental level and inherits the inherent imperfections of mind and its inability to convert and transform life. The mind is the sphere of the dualities. And just as it is impossible for it to achieve any absolute truth, but only truths relative or mixed with error, so it is impossible for it to achieve any absolute good. For moral good exists as a counterpart and corrective to evil, and has evil always for its shadow, complement, almost its reason for existence. But the spiritual consciousness belongs to a higher than the mental plane, and there the duality cease. For there, falsehood confronted with the truth by which it profited through a usurping falsification of it, and evil faced by the good of which it was a perversion or a lurid substitute, are obliged to perish for want of sustenance and to cease. The integral yoga, refusing to rely upon the fragile stuff of mental and moral ideals, puts its whole emphasis in this field on three central dynamic processes: the development of the true soul or psychic being to take the place of the false soul of desire, the sublimation of human into divine love, the elevation of consciousness from its mental to its spiritual and supramental plane, by whose power alone both the soul and the life force can be utterly delivered from the veils and prevarications of the ignorance. So, religion, in making this compact with the mind, abandons the thing that gives it life, because we all know the imperfections of religions, its partialities, its overarching ignorance. But at its best, religion takes you in a deep experience, if you follow its path, to an audience with, communion with, experience of, identity with the divine itself. The human ego, becoming naked, throwing away its vestures, enters into the embrace of the divine. Whatever else you may say about it, it can confide that. But when it makes a compact with the mind to determine what is and what isn't true, and what is the right way to approach, and how can we serve humanity by serving God, how can we serve God by serving humanity, and all the rest of it, it errs, and it falls, and it fails. But the integral yoga goes back first to discover the soul, to drop the mere vital satisfactions for the rapture of divine oneness, the communion with the Supreme. and to rise out of the falsifications and the dualities of the mind and arrive at the experience of the wider spiritual truth which underlies all, and to get to the power of a true consciousness that can transform what it looks at, and that is the supramental. So that is our goal. Sri Aurobindo, you see, is wonderfully pragmatic. These all are grand theoretical ideas, no doubt, but he lived them, he practiced them, so did the mother, and they communicated them to the most conscious, receptive audience they could find. And we now are among those people. So they still communicate with us. Let's take up the task and go farther. Well, for the moment, let's put down the synthesis of yoga and take up savitri and read that passage that I meant to draw your attention to earlier. This is in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 2, the Parable of the Search for the Soul. This begins on page 484. And if you'll forgive me, I'm going to read more than a couple of pages. I think you'll see how it summarizes everything that we've done tonight. But this is only matter's first self-view, a scale and series in the ignorance. This is not all we are or all our world. Our greater self of knowledge waits for us, a supreme light in the truth-conscious vast. It sees from summits beyond thinking mind. It moves in a splendid air transcending life. It shall descend and make earth's life divine. Truth made the world, not a blind nature force. For here are not our large diviner heights. Our summits in the superconscious blaze are glorious with the very face of God. There is our aspect of eternity. There is the figure of the God we are, his young, unaging look on deathless things, his joy in our escape from death and time, his immortality and light and bliss. Our larger being sits behind cryptic walls. There are greatnesses hidden in our unseen parts that wait their hour to step into life's front. We feel an aid from deep indwelling gods. One speaks within. Light comes to us from above. Our soul, from its mysterious chamber, acts. Its influence, pressing on our heart and mind, pushes them to exceed their mortal selves. It seeks for good and beauty and for God. We see beyond self's walls our limitless self. We gaze through our world's glass at half-seen vasts. We hunt for the truth behind apparent things. Our inner mind dwells in a larger light. Its brightness looks at us through hidden doors. Our members luminous grow, and wisdom's face appears in the doorway of the mystic ward. When she enters into our house of outward sense, then we look up and see above her sun, a mighty life self with its inner powers, supports the dwarfish modicum we call life. It can graft upon our crawl two puissant wings. Our body's subtle self is throned within in its viewless palace of veridical dreams that are bright shadows of the thoughts of God. In the prone obscure beginnings of the race, the human grew in the bowed ape-like man. He stood erect, a godlike form and force, and the soul's thoughts looked out from earth-born eyes. Man stood erect. He wore the thinker's brow. He looked at heaven and saw his comrade stars. A vision came of beauty and greater birth, slowly emerging from the heart's chapel of light, and moved in a white, lucent air of dreams. He saw his being's unrealized vastnesses. He aspired and housed the nascent demigod. Out of the dim recesses of the self, the occult seeker into the open came. He heard the far and touched the intangible. He gazed into the future and the unseen. He used the powers earth instruments cannot use, a pastime made of the impossible. He caught up fragments of the omniscient's thought. He scattered formulas of omnipotence. Thus man, in his little house made of earth's dust, grew towards an unseen heaven of thought and dream, looking into the vast vistas of his mind on a small globe dotting infinity. At last, climbing a long and narrow stair, he stood alone on the high roof of things and saw the light of a spiritual sun. Aspiring, he transcends his earthly self. He stands in the largeness of his soul newborn, redeemed from encirclement by mortal things, and moves in a pure, free spiritual realm, as in the rare breath of a stratosphere. A last end of far lines of divinity, he mounts by a frail thread to his high source. He reaches his fount of immortality. He calls the Godhead into his mortal life. All this the spirit concealed had done in her. A portion of the mighty mother came into her as into its own human part. Amid the cosmic workings of the gods, it marked her the center of a wide-drawn scheme, dreamed in the passion of her far-seeing spirit to mold humanity into God's own shape and lead this great, blind, struggling world to light, or a new world discover or create. Earth must transform herself and equal heaven, or heaven descend into earth's mortal state. But for such vast spiritual change to be, out of the mystic cavern in man's heart, the heavenly psyche must put off her veil and step into common nature's crowded rooms and stand uncovered in that nature's front, and rule its thoughts and fill the body and life. Obedient to a high command, she sat. Time, life, and death were passing incidents, obstructing with their transient view her sight. Her sight, that must break through and liberate the God imprisoned in the visionless mortal man. The inferior nature born into ignorance still took too large a place. It veiled herself and must be pushed aside to find her soul. End of Canto 2. Thank you. Namaste. Jai Ma.